commandeer Steve here in a minute, but I'm going to use him for something else in the coming year. I think we need to put together a PowerPoint presentation because trying to understand how the PCA works is more complicated than recipes I've seen for making hash. It's about the same kind of thing, too. You just put it all in there together and mix it. Would you turn to the yellow section in there and hold it up, and the yellow section, and read the last page. Tell me how many pages there are in the yellow section. Now, this is part of the Book of Church Order. How many pages is it there, Steve? This is called the Rules of Assembly Operation, just in case you didn't know. Maybe you didn't. 48 pages. Those are the instructions on how the meeting is supposed to be run. So if you want to know how the meeting is supposed to be run, you have to read all 48 pages. And it's not just reading it once. It's like a reference book, of course. But you have, if you want to know how something's supposed to happen, you have to keep your reference book there. Well, I'm not going to be doing all the speaking here. Okay. It's too hard. Didn't pass this part of the exam. Yeah, I don't have a towel. All right. And then, Steve, would you hold this up too, please? Now, every year, I think if those of you who've been here before know that there's a particular card that has a color to it. The color is meaningless, but it's somewhat, stands out so that you hold that up when you're voting. Now, you have to imagine a room full of, 1,000, 1,500 people, and when you vote on something, you can't count the hands very well. So you hold up these colored cards, and they have several assistants on the stage doing the counting. And if it's real obvious, then you don't have to vote again. If it's not obvious, then they have you stand up with your cards. And then if it's still not obvious, then they actually do an actual count so they can get a decision as to whether a particular motion passed or didn't. And then the rest of the book, short, small as you can see, that's all the reading material you're supposed to read before you get there. And that's reports on the various components of the PCA, along with some recommendations for things to occur, and you're supposed to have read it all. Thank you, Steve. You don't have to, it's not a weightlifting contest. You can put the weights down. Actually, there is one page with a menu of where you could eat in the facility. This was held in Greenville this year, and so it was, right up the road for us. Of course, people who live in Washington, the state of Washington, have a long way to come. So you have people coming from all over the country and a few from outside the country. And the Greenville area, you're probably five times more familiar with it than I am. I'd never been before, as far as I know. But it has a nice little downtown area with walking and a pleasant river that goes through and a nice overlook and nice places, restaurants and so forth. The hotels were all in this little downtown area. Then you had to drive for 10 minutes to get to their exhibition hall. And they need to work on the entrance to the exhibition hall. It looks kind of dumpy, but the rest of it was really nice. The exhibition hall was quite adequate. And so you'd go there, and of course, you drink all your water before you get there. You might find one little container of water, but otherwise you got to buy coffee for $2.50. And most of us don't like to do that, so. A few nuances, but this is like going to any conference, in part. Except that most of the time, there really is an attitude and an approach of, isn't it neat to be fellowshipping with other believers? And that's a good component piece. There are actually several components to what constitutes General Assembly in such. And part of it is what some would call a family reunion. Because a lot of the teaching elders all, of course, get to see their cronies that they went to school with years ago, and maybe some they've met more recently, or they get to see friends from Presbytery or prior General Assemblies. And even ruling elders get this if they go often enough. I got to see friends, pastoral friends of mine from the Texas area where I used to live, and often, if you're a person in the PCA, you've got at least one other relative that's in the PCA, so sometimes it really is familiar. I got to see my brother-in-law. The wives and children of teaching elders typically may come. and some wives of ruling elders, and they have programs for the women. We'll talk about those in a few minutes. But that family reunion is one way of catching part of what General Assembly is visiting, catching up with one another, and fellowshipping over food. I like that last part in particular. I'd say another part of it is edification. I put the women's ministry, how to do things, seminars, various outings for women, other seminars for even the commissioners, us attending General Assembly. There were two in particular that I went to that I thoroughly enjoyed. One, and both were what I would call conversations between two people. I didn't have to participate. I listened. That's the kind of seminar I like to go to. Where one of them was between Ligon Duncan and Al Mohler. I don't know how many of you know who Al Mohler is, but he's not a Presbyterian. He's a Southern Baptist, but he's very Reformed. And he's the president of Southern Seminary in Louisville. And if you're old enough to know what happened in the 1980s when he took over, he marched in and threw out all the liberals, the people who were questioning the inerrancy of Scripture. So he's well respected in the PCA, and it's not uncommon for him to kind of cavort with us reform people periodically. He probably receives grief from that, from his comrades, but it was really neat to listen to him and Ligon discuss issues that Christians have faced in this country over the issue of the inerrancy of Scripture. It was educational and helped me to put into historical perspective things that I heard about in the 80s when we were living in a really small town in Kentucky that didn't have any Presbyterian churches in it, no Reformed churches, and we were hearing from a Southern Baptist preacher, so it was kind of interesting to hear their perspective. The second talk that I went to was called Working Together in the PCA to Address Our Cultural Moment. Now, this was two individuals who are highly respected in our denomination, but are sometimes viewed as being on different wings of what's important, what should be done, more so than other. If you were to try to, let's see if I can draw an analogy about local churches. If you went to any two different local churches, let's say within the same denomination, you might see a different emphasis from one church to the next. That's not uncommon. I don't think that's necessarily bad. It's just a different emphasis. And so typically people may align themselves with the particular church that has the emphasis that they really like. Maybe it's a heavy-duty mercy ministry outreach. Maybe it's a global missions. Maybe they're all for sending all their congregation all the way across the world periodically. Maybe it's wanting everybody in the church to be well-educated according to not only the Scriptures, but also the Westminster Standards. There can be any combination of these things. These are all good. And so, similarly, when we talk about how to address the non-Christian in today's society, we might each have a different idea, and part of it's age-driven. There's no shock to you that I don't understand everything my 20-year-old says. And the way that she thinks, and the way her friends may think, and the way they dress, and the way they, whatever. They're just different. It's a different mindset today. And part of that is the rejection of the notion that there's something as absolute truth. Well, I grew up in the days when just about everybody thought there was some kind of absolute truth. And it might be you differed over something or other, but not quite to the vast concept of right and wrong that we have issues over today. There was no discussion of marriage being anything other than a husband and wife when I was growing up. That was the definition of it. And times change. And so the culture around us, whether we want to say it's whatever adjectives we want to use to describe the culture around us, it's certainly changing and becoming more complex in terms of each of us as individual Christians being able to minister and go up to somebody, befriend them, and introduce them to the Lord. It takes time, takes effort, got to get to know them, listen to them, and hear all these crazy ideas. So there's an art to this work today. I say more of an art than it used to be. The hour discussion was extremely helpful. Tim Keller's in New York. People in New York are different. Ligon Duncan's in Mississippi, very conservative area. So to hear these two yet talk about the same, recognizing the same cultural environment coming about, and projecting what it might be 15 years from now, was very insightful to me, because it was like, how do you prepare a 16-year-old today, your child in the church, for what they're going to be facing in college and beyond? How do you prepare them with being able to discuss, especially if you've been in a church where we haven't addressed those issues? We may know the Bible, and we may know right from wrong ourselves, but being able to defend it, you almost need a couple of courses in apologetics, how to defend the scriptures, how to know what truth is, how to debate somebody in a nice way, loving way. So I thought those were very, very helpful. So that's sort of, I put those into a category, maybe environmental. We've talked about family reunion, edification, worship services. We have had three different worship services, all on the concept of making all things new, drawn from Revelation 21. My favorite quote happened to be a sermon from 1 Thessalonians 2, which, interestingly enough, I'd just been through. You don't get to community by being liked. I thought that was a fascinating statement. So especially in the Southern culture, we tend to lean towards doing those things where people don't get angry with us. Maybe we have an aversion to conflict. And so we tend to sometimes do things that might be viewed as, quote, nice to others, but not necessarily edifying to them in the long run. Things for us to really think about. So that was very enjoyable. And then, of course, you got to think about if you've got 1,500 people in the same room, we're all singing the same song and worshiping the same God. That's pretty neat, too. Not that 5 or 10 or 20 is not great, but 1,500 is kind of neat. I felt the services were very honoring to the Lord. Before I leave this particular portion of what General Assembly is all about, I asked Janice Mutchler if she would speak just a little bit on the women's ministry that she experienced. Janice was up there along with Barbara Johnson for a day or so, and they got to participate in some of the activities. So, Janice, if you'd come at this time and give a brief description of what you learned, and you get to wear this. And you can hold it if you want, as long as they can hear you.
I don't have a pocket, so I don't have to actually hold it. I do need a hand. That's hard to pinch. Okay. Well, okay, so the thing about going to GA as a woman is that if you're not married to a ruling elder or a teaching elder, you feel like a fish out of water, because the women that are there are typically all either married to elders or they're staff women who work down the street here, or they're missionaries, or they have some official connection to the PCA. Actually, I used to have that kind of connection because I worked at the PCA Foundation for a few years, or 2.5 years, something like that, and went to 3 GAs a long, long time ago. But this is the first time that I'd been just to experience the women's ministry aspect of it. Barbara invited me to go, and we went on Wednesday and Thursday, which is when the bulk of the women's activities happened. And in Greenville, there are lots of churches in Greenville, but the women's ministry or the women's events took place mainly at Mitchell Road Presbyterian Church, which is a 10-15 minute drive outside of the downtown. I'd heard of Mitchell Road, and I may even know some folks that go to Mitchell Road, but they did a tremendous job of organizing things. Their facilities were perfect. They had a awesome nursery set up, and we saw women bringing their young children there to be dropped off and cared for during the day while the women did their own thing, which I thought was really cool. And then just all of the hostesses that wore aprons and told you where the bathroom was, or the people serving the food, they actually would look at you and say, "Hi, we're so glad that you're here." It was really nice to have that kind of effort made to really make you feel welcome. Wednesday's main program was a combination of our Jane Petit. Did you want to come up and say anything after me? Okay. Sharing a little bit about what's been going on in her own ministry. And one of the things that she mentioned was this new book from GCP, Great Commission Publications, that is an adaptation of the Pilgrim's Progress. And they were actually selling them at the at GA last week, so I picked up a couple. And, of course, my children have already started reading it and are very excited about it. So these are going to be offered, I guess, at CEMP Bookstore. And I think they had some kind of deal last week, but they're excellent, very well illustrated. I highly recommend it. You can come and see it later on afterward if you'd like. But this is actually the last thing that Tom was working on at GCP. And so it was quite a special moment to see this come out and finished. And anyway, very great. The speakers on that Wednesday program were Rod Mays, who is or was the coordinator for Reform University Ministries committee, national committee level, who, you know, is from Greenville, and his wife, Debbie Mays, who is on staff at Mitchell Road counseling, has a counseling ministry there. And they spoke on marriage again, geared toward ministry wives, particularly teaching elder, ruling elder wives, with the unique dynamic of that in a marriage. But a very honest and real and refreshing and genuine look at marriage and their own vulnerabilities and problems. And they, like, even reenacted a couple of fights so that we can, you know, identify, you know, how women and men, you know, the inevitable conflict in marriage, how that's resolved. And essentially the bottom line was your mate is clothed in the righteousness of Christ. And that's something that we kind of have to keep reminding ourselves of for the purpose of coming to a place where we can forgive them and receive forgiveness and repent. And so it's a very wonderful, well-done talk. The next day, Thursday's program was a brunch with shrimp and grits. And fortunately, the shrimp and the grits were separated, so I could just have the shrimp and not the grits. So, Laura's story was the concert. And I have to be honest, I'm not a huge, wasn't a huge Laura Story fan. Really, you know, have kind of a specific musical aesthetic. And I was looking forward to it, but was not anticipating being really touched and moved and ministered to the way that everyone was at the concert. For those that don't know her story, she is in her early 30s now, but over the last, 6-7 years has been, became a caregiver for her husband, who was diagnosed with a brain tumor not long after they married, and had major surgery and was debilitated from the surgery and has had a very, very long recovery process. And so her success in the music industry, she is a songwriter and actually now a worship leader at Perimeter, has sort of had a parallel to this huge upending event in her life. And so she really spoke from that experience of trusting in the Lord and his faithfulness to her and her husband through that, and really, truly gifted artist musically. And really spoke to us and our encouraging us and our suffering and the things that we go through are really part of God's story that he's writing. And the end of it is good, even though we may not see it in our lifetime. The end of the story is good and perfect. So I guess, Jane, if you'd like to come up, I can turn this over to you.
Can I ask Jane to come?
Yes.
At this time, and she'll report on her specific ventures.
adventures? Things you learned? She's got her name tag on. Now the ladies, do you notice any difference between the ladies' name tags and the men's name? Do you think there's something significant? Theirs have pretty art design.
And this is my book. This is my brain. Let's see if I can put this on too. Can you hear me? Oh no. Just stay right there. Okay. Thank you, Janice. Janice referenced something I wanted to follow up on. It was wonderful to be back in a church setting for our programs. It was amazing what a difference it made for us. I said I did the math, and it was in 2002 in Birmingham. It's the last time that women's ministry was able to have its programs in a local church, and it really did give us that wonderful sense of family that what is all about at women's at our women's ministry programs. This is my book. It's not as impressive as yours, but it's a busy one. We serve women in the church at GA under two purpose statements. One is to consider the privilege of leadership marriages to the ministry of the church. And secondly, in everything that we do, our prayer is that we encourage and equip leadership women in the privilege of serving the body. So take that thought and put it in context of what Janice has already told you in our two main programs, Wednesday and Thursday. But I'd like to tell you a story about a woman named Kay. Kay is a teaching elder's wife. She's from the state of Maryland. She has a PhD in art, teaches in a state college in Maryland. Very intelligent, proficient woman. On Monday afternoon and Tuesday morning, we routinely have prayer times for our women in the church. And we do it, obviously, to pray for the men and for the deliberations that are going on. But more importantly, or equally important, we seek to connect women. And Kay walked into that room, and she sort of had a little bit of an attitude, and she said to us, "I've never done this before. I'm not sure why I'm here. And I want to tell you that Kay invested the rest of General Assembly in attending everything that we had. We used that time to pray, but we also used that time to get to know one another. And there was this bond of connectionalism as PCA women in the church that was a beautiful, vibrant thing that we watched. Annie came too. Annie was a young 26-year-old Asian woman married to an American named Eric, and they're on their way to Taiwan to church plant. And those are just two faces of about 25 or 30 women in a room that were forever connected. And that's part of what I think makes GA so very special. The one thing I wanted to talk to you about, the big programs, as Janice has already mentioned, but Tuesday, going along with our theme of equipping women and encouraging women, we had three seminars that were uniquely designed for women. And I'm sorry, our Miss Jane is not here tonight because I tried my best to make her part of one of our seminars. She should have been there, but it was a little overwhelming. It was called A Journey of Calling. And they looked to some of the mothers of the PCA that were there with their husbands in 19, what? When was the PCA born? 1973. And they were there praying and supporting their husbands in those momentous decisions. And Jane and her husband, Ernest, were very involved in those early days of the PCA. But we will have an audio of that. It was just a trip back to see the cost and the prayers and the blessings of our Lord as he took us from one denomination and birthed this PCA as we know it. Another seminar that I wanted to talk to you about was very precious to my heart. And by the way, I have some things up here if you'd like to look at it. Back in October, RBI, Retirement Benefit Inc., which is one of the agencies of the PCA that is tasked with caring for wives and teaching elders, and Gary Campbell is president of RBI, and he called me to his office back in October, and he said, I want women's ministry to come alongside of us in a collaborative, proactive effort to care for the wives of PCA teaching elders. Well, I was all over that. I thought, well, yes, let's do that. So we began a journey together, and that ended up in a very equipping seminar for about 80 people called Wise Planning, Preparing for Your Future. In 2011, Gary and RBI put a survey in place for PCA teaching elders. Alan, Tom, my Tom took part in that. It was a survey to find out how financial ready you were. And I remember Tom saying to me, I know I need to do this, but I despair of the time that it will take. And he was concerned that perhaps we were not financially ready for retirement, for the next step. But 2 weeks before the Lord called him home, he said to me, during Christmas, I want us to sit down and go over this 2011 survey. It has been very valuable to me. We never had that financial discussion. But praise be to God, this is an agency that is caring for the PCA, and so we began this financial conversation with our women to build confidence in sitting down with your husband, giving them equipping resources and things that we can bring back to you here at the church. Now, we've got a lot of financial planners in this room, a lot of men who are equipped. But now we as women have a little more understanding of what's involved in being good stewards of all that God has given us. And so I'm very grateful that we could work with Christian Ed and Publications, could work with RBI in this way, and that we could equip our PCA wives. One woman said to me, and I'll close with this, I promise, said, this is probably one of the best things I've ever attended in the PCA. So that gives you a flavor of some of the purposes that we try to do at General Assembly. And let me just say one thing. I am so grateful. This represents a card of many of the women who met Tuesday night a week ago to pray for me, and I know that you prayed for me, and the Lord God was faithful.
God is in the business of being faithful, last time I checked. What a blessing. And thank you for that testimony, Jane. Mike wants to say some words about the personal resolution that he presented to General Assembly. If it's okay, I'm going to wait just a minute because I'm trying to cover a few other things. We talked about the family reunion, the edification, the worship services, and women's ministry. Another part of General Assembly is what Alan likes to refer to as a trade show. It's essentially exhibits that are present typically from seminaries. There may be 6 to 8 different seminaries represented, all very conservative and reformed. Mission agencies, some of you who've been in this church a long time ago may have gone to the Peru mission, and they were there with a little booth. Also, businesses that relate to church businesses, for example, website development, processing of credit cards. So you've got a little bit of the business aspect of churches there. Although the key piece of the exhibits is the famous PCA bookstore that is like walking into Temptation City, because you see, I want this and I want, it's like a candy store for a little child. You go into we've all had kids. They go to the candy store, they want one of each. Well, that's the way it is for many of us in the bookstore. We'd like one of each. Unfortunately, they don't provide those for free, and most of us have a limited budget. But nonetheless, we can go and our mouth can water, and sometimes we buy one or two, or some others buy more. Our own John Donahue in the room back there in the green shirt, actually it's his job to get all that stuff set up and make sure it runs properly. He is the business manager with Christian Education and Publications, and has many responsibilities. That's just one of them. So I was shocked to see you with your eyes open this morning, John, after that week of setting it up, running it, and being sure everything happens like it's supposed to. But it's a really exciting time because you do get to see some publications you might not have known about otherwise. It's far better than going, in my opinion, than going to the internet and surfing and reading all that stuff, because here you can see it all. If you're a, what do you call that kind of person that has to see it, visual learner like me, then, you know, seeing the volumes out there, you can kind of pace yourself. Well, there's this many square feet, and it's going to take me this long to get around, and I've got this much time, and I know I'll stop here and I'll come back later. And so anyway, great time. But even those books present opportunities for further learning. There was a book on resiliency of pastors as a result of some research that's been done from Covenant Seminary, who has invited back some of its graduates within less than 5 years. Because what happens, some statistics were discovered several years ago that some large percentage of pastors were leaving the ministry within 5 years of the time they graduated. That's a disaster, especially when these are capable men, but they get burned out or don't get the right resources in one way or another. And it's like going into a battlefield in some cases. Maybe they weren't prepared for certain aspects of ministry. So though we're continuing to learn things from calling recent graduates back, will they ask them questions? How's it going? What problems do you have? What things could we have done better or differently so that you could be further encouraged? And what can we do now? Just as in most academic settings today, we talk about lifelong learning. Well, it's the same process for a pastor. They don't read the scriptures and know it all after one reading, nor do we. It's a continual learning process. How do you get along with the quote unquote difficult person in the church, or how do you counsel if that's not really your particular gifting, or whatever the issue may be? And lots of things they never thought about. How do you deal with administration if you're the sole pastor and there's no administrator hired by the church? How do you do these things that you A, don't want to do, B, don't know how to do? So I was very pleased to see that study. Coincidentally enough, the nonprofit Christian organization I work for is doing a similar study for executive directors of groups that are in impoverished neighborhoods where they've set up some kind of ministry there. And the key concern is burnout and frustration and not being able to deal with the day in, day out, you know, problems that they find. I mean, these people have situations where there may be a drive-by shooting once a month. I mean, and most of us aren't prepared to handle those kind of things. So I was delighted to see that particular book, but of course there are many other books. That's just a representative sample. What some would call the main purpose of General Assembly is a business meeting run by Robert's Rules of Order, plus that 40-page yellow handout that Steve held up for you to see, which we all have to memorize. Well, not quite. We do rely on other people who've been there for years. Oh, I have to tell you a quick anecdote about a name. There was a sermon dealing with how do we reaching out to our brothers who might have a different opinion from us, and it was an excellent sermon. And we tend to give names to people, and he says at General Assembly we might have all kinds of names. One of them might be Mr. BCO Pants, and BCO is our Book of Church Order, which is the rest of that book. I'll hold that up, Steve, so everybody can see the white pages in that book. The Book of Church Orders are our rules and regulations that we go by as a church, as a denomination, as a presbytery, that give us all the things we need to be doing and the methodology with which we have to do them to some degree, all based upon Robert's Rules. So you've got to know Robert's Rules first. And I thought I knew Robert's Rules. I was the secretary in the seventh grade. I had to write minutes every time we had a class meeting. I was great. I don't know diddly squat about Robert's Rules. Relatively speaking, there's a certain core piece you got to know, and then you build on top of that. All right. So, business meeting. So you have about 10 to 12 hours of business meeting, between Tuesday night and Friday morning. And most of the people attending like it to be finished on Thursday, if at all possible. So you have the normal mundane things like electing a moderator, a person to preside over the assembly, the business meeting. That was ruling elder Bruce Terrell this year. They alternate. One year it's a ruling elder, next year it's a teaching elder. Ruling elders are somewhat challenged because unless they're practiced at presiding at presbytery meetings, it can be really challenging at General Assembly. It's not just one person standing up to speak. You've got about 8 microphones all over this area, and you've got to keep your eyes on the microphones, have the Robert's Rules of Order running around in your head, and keep track of where we are on the agenda, the docket. It really is challenging. Bruce Terrell worked for MTW for 10 years and is now administrator with one of the churches in New York, and I've met him. I had known him from maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and he is a nice guy. He found it a little challenging to have to deal with that, but the good news is you've got assistants. The stated clerk and his 2 or 3 parliamentarians are there to cohort with, you know, when there's a question that goes over your head, you're not quite sure what the answer is. That's the kind that I like. I always like to have help and assistance. So the rest of the meeting is typically reports from the committees and boards. We talk about them that way. There are 10, the administrative committee, which houses the stated clerk's office and acts as sort of a point of contact. They always have trouble raising money. Who wants to? It doesn't sound exciting to give to administration. I haven't met a nonprofit yet that likes to raise funds for administration because no donor wants to give towards administration. But it's a necessary part of life. And as a result, byproduct of that, we now charge a fee for everyone participating in General Assembly to help support the administrative committee. And that actually becomes a negative when some churches that are, say, have less than 100 people in them can't afford to pay the $450 registration fee plus travel and lodging and meals for the ruling elder, even the teaching elder to come. So we have a lot of churches that aren't represented and far fewer ruling elders than should be there. We had about, these are approximate numbers, we had about 800 teaching elders, another 400 ruling elders, for about 1,200. It might be a little bit more than that. That's roughly the split. Mission to North America, Mission to the World, Reform University Ministries, Covenant College, Covenant Seminary, PCA Foundation, PCA RBI that Jane alluded to, and Ridgehaven, which is a camp that we own. So those reports happen. There is oversight of those committees. That's a really challenging piece to communicate to you, but basically, you have a representative from each of the presbyteries that for this week acts as a supervisory committee over that specific board or agency. So for example, I got to sit through half a day of meetings for Mission of the World and hear, you know, fully understand their report, look at their financial statements, and there was a subgroup that looked at minutes and said, yes, those are written properly and documented and everything. So we have lots of oversight in our organization. That's the takeaway from that. One of the most interesting pieces of the business meeting are what they call the overtures or motions that are put forward. Typically, a presbytery might put forward a motion that we change the book of church order to do something or other. And there were roughly 23 of those submitted. Many of them, there were a couple ruled out of order. One was referred back to its presbytery, and then others were referred to different committees. One was actually approved as it was, and 2 were approved as amended. 9 were turned down. And so you have spend a lot of time on these things. The people who really spend a lot of time are the what's called the overtures committee that meets early. They meet on Monday and they go over all these recommendations and they study them and sometimes wordsmith them, and say, yes, we're going to put this forward or no, we're not, or we're just going to send it back over to this committee because it really doesn't belong to us. Mike and, Dan Wyckoff, both from our church, were the presbytery representatives to this committee from our presbytery. So if you want to know everything about overtures, you can ask Mike and Dan. They had to spend lots of extra time, and I'm sure it was both challenging but informative and educational. You get to hear how other people think around the country. That's what I think is kind of neat, That's one of the reasons I really enjoy going to a General Assembly is they'll bring up ideas I never thought of. That's kind of interesting. And you're able to kind of, it gives you a taste of the diversity of the body of Christ and how God does not do everything exactly the same way in every situation. Because he uses people. Why he uses people, I don't know. But he chooses to do his work that way, and it's our responsibility to cooperate with him and minister as he's gifted us. There were a couple of controversial issues. I'll save that. I'm going to let Mike talk about the resolution that he put forward, the overture, as it's called, the motion that he submitted, and then if he... You may want to describe what happens to it. He reads this thing before the floor, and then it goes back to the overture committee, which he was actually serving on, and they choose to modify it, send it back to the floor. He's going to distribute copies of what he actually submitted. And by the time it got through the overtures committee and back to the floor, it had been modified substantially. And as it turns out, Mike ended up... recommending that we send it back to the Overtures Committee for further review over the year. Presbyteries will also have the opportunity to put forward their versions of the resolution, and Lord willing, we might have some substantive results come out of it next year. So,
your turn.
So, like Bruce said, there are overtures that come from presbyteries, motions that come from presbyteries, but they're also allowed motions to come from people. So, in the weeks building up to General Assembly, we've recently revised our child protection policy, as some of you know. And just revisiting those issues, and we did our Stewards of Children training again back in April, and I've just been so thankful that we are in a church that's committed to protecting children and how important that is. But then, over those weeks, realizing how far we have to go as a denomination in this regard, and how many churches have no policy whatsoever, and have no training whatsoever, and how the reality of abuse, of child sexual abuse, is staggering. It's really the well-done studies that are done give statistics that are very alarming. And it's obviously not a comfortable issue to talk about. No one likes talking about it. It's horrible. But that, unfortunately, that creates an environment where it can thrive, because when we're not talking about it, when we're not on top of things like that, that's when it really does thrive. So there were several things that sort of catalyzed me saying something. I revisited a lecture by Dr. Diane Langberg, who is a PCA member and who has a, 40-year counseling ministry in the PCA with abuse situations, especially domestic abuse, and other areas, pastors who've wrecked their ministries and done great harm in the church, and abused counseling situations and counseling situations. And she was talking in this lecture about power and a theology of power and how power is to be used rightly to protect those under your charge and to serve them. And how the Bible speaks over and over again about God is a God who speaks up for the oppressed, for those who are weak, and how we are to emulate that. And so another thing that catalyzed it was, some of you might not even be aware, but there is a sort of been a, there's been a scandal in the news. There's a reformed group of churches called Sovereign Grace Ministries that are facing a lawsuit that some of the people in their church and even some of the pastors were involved in either allegedly abusing children themselves or looking the other way for a number of years, again, allegedly. And the number of witnesses now that have come forward, if you're familiar with the Penn State scandal, where they had over 10 witnesses and over 10 people have come forward, they have over 10 witnesses and people who have come forward and said, yes, this has happened in these churches. So that was very disturbing to me, that this was, again, something that's going on. You like to think of it as, well, it's those other churches, and this was very close to home. So thinking through all of that, I decided, well, I have a position. I'm a commissioner, and commissioners are allowed to bring resolutions, and we've never said anything as the PCA about this issue. So it's certainly something that we need to be more aware of and we need to work towards as a denomination. So it's totally against my nature and what I would normally choose to do, but I think it was the Spirit's leading to basically challenge me to write this and propose it. So like Bruce said, so it was Wednesday morning under new business. You're allowed to bring anything that's an item of new business. And so I stood at the mic and was recognized. And, you know, I asked that we receive this and have it spread on our minutes. So I was able to read the whole thing. And I think that in and of itself was a victory because it brought a lot of awareness. And I had a lot of conversations from people who came up to me in response to this, supporting it mostly. Almost all people who came to me, everyone who came to me actually was in support of it. And lots of stories, unfortunately, of abuse in PCA churches, and stories where even people now started watching, who were watching the assembly online, started emailing me and messaging me on Facebook because they're paying attention and they're watching. So, it, like Bruce said, it was sent to the Overtures Committee, on which Dan and I were members. And so, the short story is it got chopped up very well. And, the main thing that was taken out was the encouragement. The main thing that I think was, to me was the, you know, the turning point of why I would actually vote against it. Is that it took out the recommendation that churches report abuse. That was taken out. There was no encouragement to, instead of churches handling it in-house as a only a church discipline case, which, of course, it must be a church discipline case, but it needs to be more than that. When you have crimes that are this heinous, you need to report them. I mean, no one would think it would be appropriate to take a comparable serious crime and just handle it within the church instead of reporting it to the proper authorities. So that was done. It was referred back to the committee. And I'm very excited that I think there's many other presbyteries interested, perhaps. I made some good connections who are interested in passing a statement like this and maybe sending it up through their presbytery to Overtures. And it was very interesting. A man came up to me after I spoke against it on Thursday night, and he said, please come help me. I've got a situation I'm dealing with right now, and I don't know what to do in my church. And so we went aside, and we got to talk, and got to share with him, do you know the Georgia law actually says this? that sort of thing. So it was a very humbling experience, very daunting. It was very hard in the committee because they've got my baby here and they're chopping up my baby. And, I'm not an expert. I wouldn't call myself an expert. However, it was very apparent to me that I was one of the few, if not the only, to actually have formal training in this area in the room. And they were taking things out where I was like, wait, don't you understand? No, you haven't. And that was good for me to hear though and see. That's where we are. A lot of us don't have that training, and that's okay. We need to realize that, and now we need to start being more faithful and start challenging one another. And I said, look, if we're not going to pass a statement, that's kind of a rebuke to us and to all of us, not just you guys, to me too, that we haven't spoken up before, then it's not worth passing a statement that's watered down. Because that's all a resolution is. A resolution passed at General Assembly can't make anybody do anything. It can't mandate anything in any church. All it is simply a well-timed, hopefully, exhortation to pay attention. And for sessions to then, and presbyteries then, to give attention to an issue that is an issue of the day. And I was very thankful for the man who stood up and made the motion to recommit it to the Overtures Committee, Fred Greco, and he said, this is an issue of our day, and this is more serious than most of us realize, and how prevalent it is, and we need to take this much more seriously, and I don't think this statement is going to do it. So that was very encouraging, and I got a lot of good feedback on that. Questions? You mean in every PCA church?
Yeah, just as a standard, if you were
to take
that position, you
might have a check to make sure you have committed to the use of it. No. And the thing we don't need to do probably is mandate, you know, every detail, but what we need to do is give sessions charge of the issue and give them the tools and the resources to make those wise decisions in their context. So, you know, smaller churches, you know, that might look different from a very, very large church. And so, again, the purpose of a statement isn't to mandate details like that, although, but that's a good question. But no, that wouldn't be the goal of the statement. Again, is to tell people how to do the details. It would just be to encourage them to make sure they are seeking to act faithfully on this issue. Other questions? There was a lot of folks who, and this sounds mean, I'm not intending it to be mean at all. Their arguments demonstrated why we needed a statement, essentially most of them. And a lot of guys in the room got it, and they knew, and they were for it. But as far as, yeah, we can't, if we pass a statement that's supposed to be basically a prophetic statement in our day, because this is an issue that there's a silent epidemic. We need to call the church's attention to it because we're not preventing abuse in many of our churches. If we simply say, you know, protect our kids, that's wonderful to say, but if we don't say specifically, this means you need to report abuse, which is the crux of the issue. It would have been, you know, and of course there's other things like child protection policies, training, and that sort of thing. But if it leaves out one of the most important things, which is reporting, I had some people, again, I've never known, coming out of the woodwork, saying, thank you so much. I was abused in a PCA church. No one believed me. No one listened to me. And so to pass a statement where we're saying we care about this, we're going to try to prevent it, but not reporting, I think if we had passed that, it would have been like a punch to the gut, because we're leaving out the one thing that could have saved them and delivered them from their, you know, the living hell they went through in that situation. Owen? Sorry, Jane? Right. Well, what happened this week I take as kind of a first step. And now what my goal is I want to go to those folks who are and just say, hey guys, if nobody knows, we do have PCA experts on this issue. We have Steve Collins here locally. I'm meeting with him tomorrow. There's Dr. Diane Langberg and many, many others. And what I hope to do, Duncan Rankin, who taught systematics at RTS, who has his own tragic story, in a church in the PCA, we have denominational experts who are trained and know their stuff, and I want to draw on their wisdom in getting a statement that then has a lot of more weight behind it than just one big tall guy. I will say this, I was very humbled. Dr. Diane Langberg put its World Reformed Fellowship, picked up on the resolution and put it on their website. And Dr. Diane Langberg is on the board of World Reformed Fellowship. And she said that if it had passed, it would have been the very best statement ever passed by a denomination in the U.S., the statement that I wrote. So that was a very humbling thing and, you know, very encouraging to me that, you know what, if I have a position, I have standing in the GA, I have a standing in our presbytery, I need to use that position to advocate and to encourage our brothers who maybe, again, just aren't trained, don't know, you can prevent this, you can stop this from happening in churches. Not 100%, but you can make it very unlikely for it to happen in a church if you're doing the right things and taking responsible action. So it was very encouraging to me, and we'll see where it goes. So thanks for your prayers.
If this were part of the business meeting, we would now ask if there's a motion to extend the time because we're out of time. I just thought I'd give you a flavor for the kinds of things we had, got to experience. There were a couple of other fairly important topics I'll try to mention briefly. One was what's called insider movements. There's been a study committee on what's been known as insider movements. And that has to do with missions and how you carry out missions, which typically is called missiology. And part of that deals with how one culture takes Christianity into another culture. A classic example that missiologists will talk about is the idea that English-speaking missionaries took to Africa and insisting that they have running water and toilets and things of that nature, which were cultural issues that didn't exactly have to do with the gospel per se. But things have gotten much more complicated today. The issue typically is around when a Muslim becomes a believer, what do they call God? And what is their behavior supposed to be like? And in that context, it's a difficult question to answer. But I'll just bait you with that topic. There's a lot of homework. There were plenty of pages to read, and I'm going to have to go read them again. The bottom line is that particular motion went back to the committee for a variety of different reasons. Very, very educational, 2 hours worth of discussion, I thought. I learned a few things. There was an individual on there who had grown up in Egypt as a Coptic Christian, but been surrounded by Muslims a good part of his life, now 50 years old, and brought some insight that I had no knowledge of whatsoever, which I was very appreciative of learning. The issue of paedo communion typically comes up each year. We have some teaching elders, in particular in the Pacific Northwest Presbytery, which is the far western large portion of the United States, who some of those teaching elders believe that you should allow an infant to participate in communion. They tie that back to the concept of, well, we baptize an infant, why don't we allow the other sacrament to be administered to a child? And there are biblical issues, pro and con, and does the issue of Paul's admonition about examining ourselves apply to the infant or not? And it gets very theologically complicated. I'm not a proponent of it. Most in the PCA are not. The issue has to do with why do they keep admitting these teaching elders with that exception? Is, you know, what's going to happen down the road? Is it a slippery slope? So there are a ton of related questions that come up. We don't have a great way of dealing with the issue, per se, within the mechanism of the PCA. So it typically comes up through a review of presbytery records.
And if the presbytery doesn't document very, very, very carefully what they've allowed, why they've allowed it, then it raises more questions. So that we spent several hours on that topic. I really wanted to talk about budgets. However, since I'm probably the only one in the room interested in that, I will not bore you with that. But it is it's interesting. There is not a board or agency that is not cutting ministries because they're not adequately funded. I'll just say that. I used to know 10 years ago, I could tell you the figure of how many missionaries were candidating and how much money it would take to send all of them out today. It was something like $2 million at the time. Well, that was 10 plus years ago. And they're just not getting enough funds to support the ministries they'd like to do. Just a side word. We'll return. I think we have a hymn left. .342, Christ has made the sure foundation. So let's stand and sing that together, and then we'll be dismissed.